You're listening to Heaven is Round, a Chinese theory of cyclical change. My name is Alice, I'm the author, and I'm reading Foundation 2, Mission of the Five Elements. Introduction. The Five Elements is the best known translation of Wu Xing. It's used by Westerners doing their Tai Chi classes, and indeed most Chinese people. In the last few decades, however, the Five Elements has been deemed to be inaccurate by scholars East and West, and alternative translations have been put forward. But it's been around for so long, four centuries in fact, so goes one argument for upholding the elemental status quo. Besides, if Chinese people use this translation, surely it must be authentic. Perhaps. But where did they get it from? It was Jesuit priests on a mission to convert Chinese souls to the Catholic faith in the late 16th century who chose to translate Wu Xing as the Five Elements. An obvious choice, no doubt, since Jesuit education was still steeped in Aristotelian logic, including the mutable properties of the Greek four elements, fire, water, earth, and air. As they compared Wu Xing to their own traditions, the theory was deemed to be illogical. Renowned among the Jesuits in China was Father Matteo Ricci. He paved the way for Jesuits to work at the upper echelons of the Ming imperial court. Towards the end of his life, he was even invited to live and work within the hallowed grounds of the imperial city. A prodigious author and able linguist, Ricci translated classics of Western thought into Chinese and classics of Chinese thought into Latin, thus conveying the ideas and ideals of Europe and China to each other for the first time. Through studying revered ancient Chinese texts, Ricci formed an impression of Wu Xing from some of its earliest descriptions. I introduce the conclusions he reached and how they reflected the mission as a whole. A couple of dates. Matteo Ricci was born in Italy in 1552 and died in China in 1610. The Ming dynasty dates are 1368 to 1644. The Jesuits arrived during the last century of this dynasty. You'll find throughout this issue that I review the dates of people and eras at an appropriate point to have a quick pause and then carry on with the main story. An important acknowledgement for this issue, sections 4, 5 and 6 explore Matteo Ricci's critiques of Wu Xing. They are drawn from an article by the Taiwanese scholar Su Quang Tai, so I owe a huge debt to him for his illuminating research. Many thanks to Catherine Jamy, editor of the East Asian Science, Technology and Medicine Journal, for granting me permission to quote his translations of Ricci's writings. You can find a link to this paper in the notes of the written version of this issue, as well as biographies of Matteo Ricci and other sources. Let's now set the scene with the religious turmoil of mid-16th century Europe. Mission of the Five Elements, Section 1, Climbing the Ladder of Influence. Mid-16th century job description. Are you ambitious, intelligent, curious, a pragmatic idealist? Do you want to travel the world, learn languages and meet people of other cultures? Do you aspire to high standards of moral conduct? Can you endure hardship to support a cause you believe in? Are you passionate about educating the heathen masses in the ways of our Father and his mathematical modelling of the cosmos? Enter the Society of Jesus, founded in 1540 by Ignatius of Loyola, a former soldier whose austere ways were in such contrast to Catholic indulgences that the Jesuit order helped to stem the Protestant tides flooding through Europe at that time. These men of divine action didn't hang about in the back alleys of Rome offering to read your fortune for a few ducats, or live secluded lives in wealthy monasteries. Young Jesuits studied Greek, Latin, history, logic, rhetoric, mathematics, and astronomy before progressing to 4 years of theology and then dispatched to missions around the world. Madiorici was born during the Council of Trent, the Catholic ecumenical council set up in response to the Protestant Reformation. Copernicus had recently published his work on heliocentric theory, that the Earth orbits the Sun, not the other way round, submerging Western cosmology in ever deeper water. In the year of Ricci's birth, the first Jesuits landed on Chinese shores and tentatively knocked at the door of the Middle Kingdom. When Ricci arrived in China, aged 30, fresh from the final hurdles of priesthood, that door began to edge ajar. 3 dates before continuing with the story, Ignatius of Loyola was born in 1491 and died in 1556. Copernicus, his dates are 1473 to 1543, and the Council of Trent lasted from 1545 to 1563. Let's carry on. As was the case in all four corners of the missionary globe, Jesuits faced considerable obstacles to establishing a presence in China. Only a handful of them were given the China Brief, yet there were at least 60 million Chinese. In terms of potential converts, it was a ratio of about 12 million per Jesuit. The road from the port of Macau to the imperial city in Beijing was dogged by political and spiritual potholes. In the early days, converts were thin on the ground. On the leaderboard of saved souls, Jesuits in Japan were scoring far higher. The Ming imperial court not only had the headache of Western merchants and missionaries washing up on Chinese shores, fears of foreign invasion were further exacerbated by a terrifying force of 15,000 Japanese Christian soldiers marching up the Korean Peninsula. Their fearsome presence would have hardly helped the uphill struggle of public relations for Jesuits in China. As a result, the policy of proselytization was to make Christianity and its bearers of glad tidings palatable to the cultural taste buds of the Chinese. The initial approach was straightforward enough. Blend in. Tall, hairy, Mediterranean men shaved their heads, dressed in the robes of Buddhist monks, and learned local customs. Quite how far this strategy of accommodating Chinese ways for Christian ends could stretch before losing integrity plagued the mission throughout. Eventually, it came to affect all orders with missions in China, with stark consequences. The Jesuits found that their presence was best supported by local government officials wherever they could establish good relations with them. However, the imperial civil service traditionally operated on the basis of transfer every few years. Therefore, just as the Jesuits had built up enough goodwill and protection to set up shop, so to speak, if their local ally was transferred to a far-flung outpost of the Chinese Empire, their missionary groundwork was undone and their safety jeopardised. This led Ricci to concentrate on scaling the tiers of government to gain a steadier foothold. Only a settled mission could attract more converts and offer continuing pastoral care for them. His ultimate goal was the very top. If the reclusive Wanli Emperor would wave a benign flag over the Jesuits' presence, their passage through the empire would be slightly less fraught with mortal danger. The Wanli Emperor is the 14th emperor of the Ming dynasty. He reigned for a long time, from 1563 to 1620. Over time, Ricci came to realise that Buddhist monks were too low on the social ladder to climb its slippery rungs. Status cuts both ways when a deal is being sought, even a spiritual deal. To impress those of high status, he had to indulge in power dressing. After spending over 10 years wearing the robes of a Buddhist mendicant, he sought permission from his superior to change his outfit to the fine swathes of silk worn by the educated elite when they visited each other's residences. Adorned in silks and transported in a sedan chair, Ricci attended social networking events with the Ming Dynasty literati, a word the Jesuits chose to refer to the learned men who comprised the vast ranks of government. The majority of these men of letters were, however, drawn to the mathematical and scientific knowledge of the Jesuits rather than their religious beliefs. The oil painting of a mother and child on the wall of the mission house was less enticing than whirring clocks, colourful prisms, and the fascinating computations of astrolabes. Moreover, conversion to Christianity meant forsaking the company of concubines, let alone the humiliation of bowing before a foreign priest during a service. Such slights of status did not befit men of their standing. Those willing to convert were more likely to be retired, as the perils of the career ladder and pleasures of concubines no longer held their former appeal. The paradox was plain and simple. To safeguard the mission as a whole, the Jesuits needed to gain friends in high places. Yet the literati were the social strata least likely to become Christians. The more time spent entertaining their intellectual curiosity, the less time was available for the grassroots work of conversion. All souls have equal worth in the light of the Lord. But if they could not establish a safe basis to save souls in the first place, everyone was doomed. Healing the sick and infertile among the lower orders led to more converts, but the greatest miracle of all would be the emperor's approval. Onwards was upwards. End of section 1. Mission of the Five Elements, section 2. Proving the existence of God in ancient China. The literati were versed in a set of texts collectively known as the Five Classics. For all young men aspiring to join the ranks of government, the first rung of the career ladder was to pass a written examination in these venerable works. This system had been in place, more or less, for 1,500 years. By the Ming Dynasty, the core curriculum had expanded to include the four books, and moreover, centuries of commentaries also had to be digested and regurgitated. The exams were ferociously tough, no cheating was allowed, and they provoked such stress levels that some candidates appeared to be possessed by demons. Students today would surely sympathise. Jesuits also had a highbrow education with tests that were equally exacting. Ricci thus felt at home not only with the rigours of study, but also the content of these great works, replete as they were with worthy counsel on how to live a virtuous life. Let's see if I can pass a brief oral examination. So the five classics are the documents, Shang Shu, that's the main one we'll be referring to, the odes or songs, Shi Jing, the changes, Yi Jing, the rites, Li Ji, and the annals, the spring and autumn annals, Chun Qiu, and the four books are the Analects of Confucius, Lun Yu, the Mencius, Meng Zi, the Great Learning, Da Xue, and the Doctrine of the Mean, Zhong Yong. So Ricci was given the daunting task of translating excerpts of these works into Latin. The project led him into deep theological water. In the classics, he noticed two terms that implied some sort of supreme deity. There was Tian, the sky or heaven, as well as Shang Di. Shang means high, above, or lofty, and di means a deity, a god, and it was also used to refer to an emperor. Tian and Shangdi appeared to be used interchangeably, as if one supreme god had two names. Michel Ruggieri, a Jesuit who arrived in China earlier than Ricci, had already translated Deus, that's God in Latin, as Tianqiu, the Lord of Heaven. The more Ricci delved into the classics, however, the more he was convinced that the people of ancient China had worshipped only one god. In his thinking, the myriad deities of the 16th century must have deviated from a once pure monotheistic source. In other words, for Chinese people, this Lord of Heaven was a foreign god worshipped by missionaries and their converts. But for Jesuits, there was only one god, ever, anywhere. Shangdi was in fact the high god of the Shang dynasty. However, the oracle bones were still buried in the soil during Ming dynasty times. The scope of Shang beliefs was only unearthed in the 20th century, as mentioned at the beginning of the last issue. Shangdi certainly had the lofty attributes of a creator god, but nature spirits and royal ancestors also populated the Shang pantheon. In other words, polytheism was not a deviation from a once pure monotheistic source. It had been the norm for at least 2,000 years before Ricci came to China. But as far as he was concerned, or wanted to be concerned, Shangdi was not a god, but the god. He writes, "He who is called the Lord of Heaven in my humble country is he who is called Shangdi in Chinese." As a result, he permitted the converts to use Tian, Shangdi, or Tianqiu interchangeably, since they were all names for God. In the five classics, Ricci gleaned the presence of a supreme God. In the four books, he gleaned a humanistic practice of self-cultivation associated with the teachings of Confucius. Combined, he drew parallels to his Catholic faith. The allure of monotheism and humanism inspired his missionary zeal. The tenets of Christianity were not religious imports from the far west. Equivalent beliefs lay in Chinese antiquity. All he had to do was reveal this universal truth through these venerable texts. If God had simply been forgotten about in the mists of time, Ricci was saving the Chinese from their own fall from grace. Lucky them. Steeped in the teachings of Thomas Aquinas, Jesuits held that the natural light of reason was the first step along the path to conversion. The existence of God and validity of Christian doctrines had to be proved by reason. More to the point, to use reason to point out the fallacies of other faiths. I think only Mr. Spock of Star Trek could be persuaded to convert on this basis, and I doubt he would subscribe to any religion in the first place, except for arcane rituals to honour Vulcan ancestors. Poor and illiterate converts were persuaded by miraculous healing, not logical argument. The natural light of reason was only reasonable if it made a tangible difference to their meagre lives. To elevate the link between the Chinese classics and Christianity, Ricci set out to refute other native traditions. In his scholastic line of fire were Buddhists, those low-status, veggie-eating atheists whose robes he had worn for 10 years with scant missionary success. Taoists, polytheistic idol worshippers obsessed with elixirs of immortality, as well as Neo-Confucianists, who sought to restore the true Confucian way from earlier eras, but drew on Taoist and Buddhist ideas. Clearly they were a bunch of lost souls caught in a quagmire of cross-spiritual purposes. All Ricci had to do was lift the veils of Buddhist atheism, Taoist polytheism and neo-Confucianism and all the veggie-eating, alchemical smoothie-drinking lost souls would surely see the light of the one true God. In his own words, Taoists and Buddhists are all produced by our great Father, the Lord of Heaven, and we are therefore all brothers. For example, if my younger brother goes mad and falls to the ground, should I, as his elder brother, pity him or hate him? What is most important is that we should employ reason to explain the truth and make things clear to them. Pretty patronizing, don't you think? Ricci aimed to disprove Buddhist and Taoist beliefs through the guise of familiar Confucian teachings, such as an older brother looking out for a younger brother, but with the ulterior motive of proving the superiority of Christianity. It would be as if a Buddhist monk lifted choice passages from the Bible to teach the Dharma to Christians, while also pointing out inconsistencies in the Holy Scriptures in order to persuade Christians to convert to Buddhism. Hardly a way to win friends and influence people. A Chinese scholar wrote, "The barbarians began by attacking Buddhism. Next, they attacked Taoism. Next, the later Confucianism, Neo-Confucianism. If they have not yet attacked Confucius, that is because they wish to remain on good terms with the literate elite and the mandarins in order to spread their doctrine. But they are simply chafing at the bit in secret and have not yet declared themselves." Ricci admitted as much when he wrote to his Jesuit superior, "And I am very keen that they should also regard me in that light," meaning praising Confucian teachings, "for we should have much more to do if we were obliged to fight against all three sects." End of section 2. Mission of the Five Elements, section 3. The Four Elements of Greek Natural Philosophy. Ricci used a similar tactic to critique Wu Xing. In this case, he employed Aristotelian logic to refute the tenets of the theory. Jesuit education lay at a tricky cusp of Christian beliefs, Greek natural philosophy, and the scientific revolution. Jesuits were keen scientists, but in the 16th century, the periodic table of chemical elements had not yet been formulated. Therefore, the four traditional elements of earth, air, fire and water still held sway as the material means by which God had created the world. Natural philosophers in the 6th century BCE envisaged a kind of primordial matter which could be neither created nor destroyed and from which all phenomena were born. Water was a prime candidate, as well as pneuma, which is often described as air, breath, wind or spirit. Following on from this idea, Empedocles posited four primordial substances, earth, air, fire and water, which he called roots. He also described them as deities, thus stressing their eternal nature. While the four roots could be neither created nor destroyed, he proposed two forces, love and strife, that act upon the four roots. Love was the force of attraction by which the roots combined in different ways to create phenomena. Taken to an extreme, the force of love would merge the four roots into a sphere of unity, but then there would be no distinct forms. Strife was the force of repulsion that impelled the roots to go their separate ways, creating distinctions. But if all were rent asunder in the vortex of strife, nothing would exist at all. It was the dynamic tension of love and strife acting on the four roots that engendered everything, from stars to plants. Empedocles should be compulsory reading on all relationship counselling courses. He was born circa 494 BCE and died 60 years later. Plato chose the word stichion, for earth, air, fire and water, which implies the basic units of a composite. For example, the letter D cannot be reduced to a more basic letter, but combined with O and G, it can form different words. Another example is the primary colours, red, blue and yellow, which combine to make secondary colours such as purple and orange. The four elements are primary bodies out of which composite bodies such as plants and animals are formed. It is this word, stichion, which has been translated as element. Aristotle focused on their properties, hot, cold, wet, dry, heavy and light. But since hot things can cool down and damp things can dry out, so the four elements were mutable and relative. As the heaviest element, the propensity of earth was to move downwards and form land. Water was relatively heavy as it flowed around the land. Air was relatively light, forming the atmosphere. And fire was lighter again as it formed the sun. As for the fifth element, ether, in Aristotle's thinking, it was the composition of stars and its motion was circular. Ether made the heavens go round. Educated in such esteemed traditions, Ricci naturally compared Wuxing to these four elements. But looking at one theory through the lens of another, the logic of the Chinese system did not stack up. He writes, by adding metal and wood and subtracting air, they count five elements, metal, wood, fire, water and earth. Still worse, they make out that these elements are engendered the one by the other, and it may be imagined with how little foundation they teach it. But as it is a doctrine handed down from their ancient sages, no one dares to attack it. In fact, Wuxing attracted critics as far back as its initial dissemination. But venerable axioms are indeed hard to challenge. Firstly, the logic of how one element engendered the other, in his words, how one element generated the next element, didn't make sense to him. Second, he was confounded by the lack of air but a surfeit of qi. Third, he saw metal and wood as composite, not primary bodies, the elemental equivalent of purple and orange. Let's take a look at each point in turn. Two more dates here. Plato was born circa 428 BCE and died 348 BCE. Aristotle's dates are 384 to 322 BCE. This era of history is what Carl Jaspers calls the Axial Age. So it's a very similar timing to the burgeoning ideas of the warring states over in China. End of section 3. Mission of the Five Elements, Section 4. Upending the Logic of Transformation. There are two main sequences by which the five phases generate and control each other. Describing the cycle of generation, Ricci writes, thus it was said that wood comes from water, fire from wood, earth from fire, metal from earth, and water from metal. It is really hard to follow this theory. I sympathise. Metal generating water is pretty weird. As a mnemonic, think of trees needing water to grow. Timber is burnt to generate fire. The ashes of fire feed the soil. Ores lie within the soil. And the last one is tricky, but in early China, water was found where ores were mined. Ricci used the self-evident reasoning that trees cannot grow from water alone to pick holes in the logic of the generating cycle. He writes, wood is of fire and earth, meaning sunlight and soil. How could it be generated by water alone? And before the existence of fire and earth, how could wood have been completed on its own? If wood were generated before the existence of earth, where should the already existing tree be planted? In other words, in the generating cycle, the only thing that generates wood is water, and it is wood that then generates fire and earth. But trees, as he points out, need fire, sunlight, earth, soil, and water to grow. So how does the tree grow? The complementary cycle has a controlling factor. A traditional mnemonic goes like this. Earth dams water. Water extinguishes fire. Fire melts metal. Metal chops wood. And wood breaks up earth, which is a possible reference to wooden ploughs. The theory operates on the basis that the five phases mutually regulate each other's powers, so balance is maintained. The generating cycle ensures the waxing of each phase. It comes into its full power. And the control cycle ensures its powers wane in favour of the next phase. The traditional term for the control cycle implies conquest. But because both cycles operate simultaneously, there is no outright destruction. For example, if water generates wood, which in turn generates fire, water cannot completely destroy fire because wood is providing enough fuel to keep the flames alight. Yet water ensures that fire does not get out of control. It fans the flames down so that fire can transform into earth. In this way, the two cycles create a constant flow of change and interaction, forming a dynamic model of self-regulation, which was not as vogue in Ricci's time as it is nowadays. If you're not quite following this, don't worry. I'm going to go over it many, many times. Back to Ricci, who used the traditional descriptions to question the logic of how the two sequences operate together. In the following quote, written about 2,000 years ago, the generating cycle is likened to the parent-child relationship. For example, if fire generates earth, then fire is the parent of earth. If earth generates metal, earth is the parent of metal, and so on. And this quote is traditionally ascribed to a Chinese philosopher called Dong Shengshu. Here goes. What bestows anything is always the parent. What accepts it is always the child. Constantly relying on the parent to direct the child is the way of nature. Therefore, the five phases are actually the actions of the filial child and loyal minister. In this quote, the generating cycle is described as a natural order. Parent and child, ruler and minister reflect the natural hierarchy of above and below, like heaven and earth, or hills and valleys. Human relationships must reflect this natural order. In other words, it's simply natural to feel eternally grateful to our elders and betters. More to the point, feelings of disloyalty are unnatural and not the way of nature. Whatever the political subtext of this passage may have been at the time of writing, a good 15 centuries before Ricci came to China, the parent-child analogy subsequently stuck like glue to the generating cycle, and Ricci used it to critique the apparently flimsy logic of wuxing. In Chinese family values, grandfather and grandson share an innate sympathy and similarity. If wood is fire's parent, then water is fire's grandparent. He writes, as water brings forth wood and wood produces fire, then because water is the grandfather and fire the grandson, how come the grandfather and grandson are so dissimilar to each other? Why is grandfather so heartless to his grandson and always wants to destroy him? In short, why does Grandpa throw a wet towel over his grandson's sunny personality and extinguish the bright light in his eyes? The argument was designed to tug at the intellectual heartstrings of the literati. Come on, let's do it in Italian. Come on, you love your grandson, right? You think he's got your nose and eyes? So how come your five-element theory does not reflect the affection you feel for him? It was a typical Ricci ruse to use a tenet of Chinese beliefs and practices he agreed with, such as harmonious family relations, in order to disprove the logic of those he did not favour, such as Wu Xing. End of section 4. Mission of the Five Elements, section 5. Exorcising Qi. Another of Ricci's critiques of Wu Xing was the dearth of the element air and a preponderance of Qi. I mentioned Qi briefly in Foundation 1, section 3. Qi is typically translated as life force, energy, or vitality. But since a precise translation is elusive, I'll continue to use Qi. He writes, as they do not know what air is, where we say that there is air, they affirm that there is a void. There was not a void as such, but highly diffuse Qi. It is Qi that is inhaled and exhaled. Qi can also mean to breathe. Qi is not only air as a source of life, it also imbues food with its nutritive value. The qi of mountain air and fresh food has more vitality than polluted city air and stale food. Although the word qi is not found on the oracle bones, its two graphs do date back to the oracle script. The top graph depicts vapours or clouds, and the bottom graph is grains of rice. Before rice became a staple grain, it may have been provided as a luxury food or drink, as rice wine, at feasts. Feasts were a key part of ancestor worship, as far back as Shang times. Qi not only implies steam and vapour, but also smell, such as the wafting aromas of cooking rising up to the sky. Ancestors were enticed to come down from their celestial abodes by these sumptuous aromas. They feasted on the sights, sounds, and smells of a spectacle presented in their honour. Having been wined and dined, these spiritual elders and betters conveyed messages to distant ancestors, who would then inform the high god, Shangdi, about the good deeds of their living descendants. The ancestors and Shangdi could bring fortune or misfortune upon the living, fertile crops and animals, or floods and droughts. We'll look at this theme again in the next issue, Foundation 4. Qi implies power and vitality from an ineffable, invisible source. Perhaps that source was once ancestral. I've added quite a few notes to this point, which I'll summarise at the end of this section. Let's carry on. Another rendering of atmosphere is feelings and moods, not only of people, but also places and events. Qi is seen to be the source of those subtle qualities. Is the qi of love or strife gaining the upper hand in the couple's therapy session? Spirits are also atmospheric entities. An exam candidate, possessed by a demon bent on career failure, needed to have malign qi exorcised from his stressed-out nervous system. Ricci, however, wanted to exorcise qi and replace it with air, because its cosmological remit did not fit his ancestral paradigm. Since both theories shared fire, earth, and water, and qi does have an atmospheric nature, qi is surely air, and his Chinese colleagues are surely mistaken. Rather than thinking in terms of the four elements, it is perhaps better to compare qi to the earlier strata of Greek natural philosophy, in which all phenomena is born out of the same primordial substance. Water was one proposition, and qi has been likened to water's changes of state, from solid to fluid to gas. Another was pneuma, air, breath, wind, or spirit, which is an older translation of qi. In recent decades, qi has been likened to quantum field theory. But a 16th century viewpoint is perhaps more appropriate in this context than waves and particles. In which case, I would like to focus on its similarities to pneuma. Pneuma was seen as an internal form of air, a life-giving vapour that circulated in the body alongside blood and nourished vital organs. Pneuma was also seen as the source of thoughts and feelings. Aristotle envisaged an innate form of pneuma, a hot, foamy substance, similar in composition to stars, which originated in the heart and was transmitted by semen as the essence of life to offspring, women only providing a child's physical form. In Chinese medicine, likewise, qi nourishes vital organs, the heart is the source of thoughts and feelings, and both qi and blood circulate along internal channels. At least the qi of men and women provided the essence of life to the next generation. In meditation practices, the more you can refine the qi circulating in your body through subtle breathing techniques and a calm heart, the more spirit-like you will become. You may even live forever, or certainly longer than people whose vitality ebbs away due to polluted city air, stale food, low-status ancestors, and other social ills. As pneuma was still part of medical practice when the Jesuits came to China, the similarities would have only strengthened Ricci's argument that qi was, in fact, air. Blowing his own trumpet, as if to prove the existence of air, he writes, "Father Matthew," referring to himself, "told them that there were four elements, no more or no less, possessed of contradictory qualities, and he taught them where each element was found. Father Matthew wrote a commentary on this subject in Chinese, in which he did away with their five elements as such, and established the four, to which he assigned locations, and of which he showed illustrations. This commentary was received with great interest. They had numerous copies of it made, which were everywhere accepted with the same high praise as his other writings." End of section 5. Mission of the Five Elements, section 6. The four elements are closer to Genesis. The philosophical notion of a primordial substance such as water or pneuma, or Empedocles' four roots, was superseded by the Christian creed that only God is eternal. All matter can be created and destroyed. Yet the first lines of Genesis still allude to this legacy of wind and water. "In the beginning of creation, when God made heaven and earth, the earth was without form and void, with darkness over the face of the abyss, and a mighty wind that swept over the surface of the waters." The mighty wind is also translated as the Spirit of God, meaning the Holy Spirit, who is closely associated with pneuma. In brackets I've put here, pneumatology is the study of the Holy Spirit, not the study of car tire pressure. A devout Christian's thoughts and feelings are guided by the Holy Spirit in accord with God's will. The waters were the protean matter separated by God in order to create heaven and earth. I'm not sure how the four elements are construed from Genesis, but for 16th century Jesuits, God fashioned the cosmos through earth, air, fire, and water. They are simple elements from which everything else is formed. For Ricci, and this is his third critique of Wuxing, wood and metal were not simple elements, but rather products of the four elements. He writes, It is admissible to speak of water, fire, and earth as simple elements. But what reason would there be to regard metal and wood as primary elements? If one, for instance, examines the composition of the myriad things, such as human beings, insects, birds, and animals, then one will readily see that most of them are not composed of metal and wood. Chemistry was still playing catch-up in the 16th century, let alone that metals and carbon are first forged in stars. And who knows where the bionic human race is going, but there was another twist to the plot of relegating metal and wood to the secondary league tables of creation. In this next passage, Ricci is reflecting on the Documents, one of the five classics. He writes, I have read in the Shang Shu, the Documents, about the inception of things by Yao and Shun, but it is only said they are crucial for the people's livelihood, and nowhere are metal, wood, water, fire, and earth called primary, meaning elements, and the origin of the myriad things. Yao and Shun are two legendary prehistoric rulers. Arichi is right. The scant references to metal, wood, water, fire, and earth in the classics do emphasize them as natural resources for daily life. Ricci held great store by the classics because he read into them proof that ancient Chinese people had once worshipped a single creator god, Shang Di, whom he believed to be God. By extrapolation, anything else in the classics was closer to the source of God in ancient China, while other literature had digressed from this abiding truth. And perhaps he took the same stance with Wu Xing. References in the classics were authentic, the real meaning, while other descriptions were suspect. On this basis, he could consign not only metal and wood, but all of Wu Xing to a secondary stage of creation. By means of the four elements, God fashioned the sky, earth, dry land, plants, animals, and humans, all within 6 days. Ask a busy deity. The material resources for daily life are post-fall. Cast out of the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve faced the brave new world of earning a living. However, chopping wood and carrying water, making fires, smelting metal, digging soil and growing crops had nothing to do with the origins of the cosmos. The Chinese five elements were, therefore, a functional byproduct of the Greek four elements. There's an important issue of timing here. Early descriptions of Wu Xing imply natural resources. By the time Jesus was in nappies, if they had nappies back then, the theory had been reconceived as five phases of qi, which did have a cosmogonic remit. Primordial qi initially differentiated into sunny, lighter, yang qi to form the sky, and dark, heavier, yin qi to form the earth. Qi then further differentiated through Wu Xing. For example, water qi engendered water as a substance, as well as watery things, such as turtles, fish, and a salty taste. Fire qi engendered birds with feathers for flying. Metal qi gave animals their cutting fangs and biting stings. In short, while yin yang was bequeathed the elegance of physics, Wu Xing was saddled with the complex variables of life and evolution. At least the Chinese envisaged cosmogenesis as a process which took place over aeons, whereas for Ricci, God fashioned the world by means of four elements in 6 days, followed by a day off. A robust dialogue no doubt accompanied many a social networking event. Back to the issue of timing. The classics incorporated a range of stories, speeches, poems, and state records. In the 2nd century BCE, this material was consolidated in order to form a curriculum for the newly instigated examination system. All young men aspiring to join the ranks of government had to take the test. By then, Wu Xing had already begun to transform into a theory of cyclical cosmic powers, but in literature that either postdates the classics or was never incorporated into them. Ricci would have surely known of the cosmogonic remit of Wu Xing, but he had grounds to dismiss it because this development was not included in the classics. As such, it could not have been the belief of those ancient Chinese people who worshipped the one true God. Or so he imagined. Or so I speculate. End of section 6. Mission of the Five Elements, section 7. Translating Wu Xing as the Five Elements. Among the early Jesuits in China, Ricci was the most able linguist and a prolific author. Translating Wu Xing as the Five Elements may not have been his choice alone, but its dissemination in Europe as well as the Four Elements in China was initially by his hand. He knew very well that Xing meant to go and to do, as we looked at in the last issue, Foundation 2. He used it this way in one of his first publications in Chinese. In the book of 25 paragraphs, Ricci adapted the sayings of the Stoic philosopher Epictetus in order to convey Christian values to a Chinese audience. The Stoic teachings are about not dwelling on events beyond your control, but focusing on what you can control, which is your behaviour. The wise words of Epictetus were undergoing a popular resurgence in Europe during the 16th century. And I might add, they've also been used by the 12-step programs. In order to translate this work, the book of 25 paragraphs, Ricci drew upon Chinese phrases and ideas that would have been familiar to his readers. One such phrase was zhe xing, knowledge and action, with xing being action. In brief, and in light of earlier descriptions of pneuma and Chinese medicine, if the heart is the seat of consciousness, it is also the seat of conscience. With moral awareness comes an imperative to act in line with your beliefs, to walk your talk. Xing implies your conduct, the step-by-step actions that are guided by your heart. Xing also implies skilled action, such as craftsmanship. With practice, your moral actions can also become more skillful. That is the gist of self-cultivation that I assume Ricci saw as a common thread in Stoic, Christian, and Confucian teachings. But it is speculation on my part. Perhaps the connotation of skilled action also reiterated his view that Wu Xing concerned practical livelihood, not cosmogonic processes. If so, it could have been translated as the five actions or five resources. Yet having decided that Wu Xing was a theory of basic elements, but one that did not make sense if viewed through the lens of Aristotelian logic, the five elements were a misguided, inferior version of the four elements. Aside from comparing Chinese and Greek natural philosophies or Christian and Confucian moral sensibilities, a simple reason to translate Wu Xing as the five elements was its similar practical applications to the four elements. Both were used in medicine, astrology, and alchemy. The grey area for Jesuits in both systems was divination. To scope out your future through divination and thus stave off potential misfortune was effectively to lack trust in God. God's will is divine, it does not need to be divined. One fervent acolyte was not only a decorated military veteran, but also a renowned feng shui expert. In order to make the leap of faith required to become Christian, his treasured and expensive collection of divination manuals were put on a funeral pyre and burnt to ashes, along with the beliefs they contained. Ricci did not pressure him to convert and supported him in the wake of such a sacrifice, but the use of wuxing in divination would have hardly endeared the theory to a Jesuit priest. Indeed, Ricci grew weary of rumours that the hairy medicine men of the far west knew the alchemical means to turn mercury into silver, rather than any true interest in the miracle of divine intervention. Such solutions were still sought after by ageing emperors who drank dubious protein shakes that promised eternal life, or just improved their libido sufficiently to reinvigorate themselves through the regenerative allure suffusing their pleasure quarters. If only Ricci could persuade the Wanli emperor, a world-weary, overweight recluse, that seeing a miraculous apparition of the Virgin Mary was a more fulfilling form of regeneration. The emperor must have been a sorry sight, stuffing his face with comfort food in the recesses of his palace. No wonder he stayed out of view. Since a fifth element had always been floating around the ether, the similarities of the two theories must have made the five elements an obvious choice. After all, the Jesuits were grappling with translating hallowed Chinese texts into Latin, cautious diplomatic encounters with the imperial court, violent attacks on their properties and brethren, all the while predicting eclipses and teaching trigonometry. An accurate translation of Wu Xing could hardly have been a priority. That Ricci gave the theory any attention at all is testimony to his resolve to learn about all things Chinese. It would have been only natural to translate Wu Xing as the five elements, as natural as an emperor in the throes of a midlife crisis being attracted to nubile young women. End of section 7. Mission of the Five Elements, section 8. Mapping Heaven and Earth. It took Ricci and his companions close on two decades to navigate the political and spiritual potholes from Macau to Beijing. The invitation to live and work in the imperial city was due to their astronomical rather than religious knowledge of heaven's order. Some of Europe's leading astronomers were Jesuits. Incorporating a new god from the far west was no problem. The more the merrier in the Chinese pantheon. Of greater importance was to ensure that all deities were venerated on the right day. This had been true since the Shang kings had wined and dined their spiritual superiors at ancestral feasts. To do so entailed precise astronomical observations and mathematical calculations. If the calendar goes out of sync with the seasons, which it easily does over a few generations, a ruler is asking for misfortune to knock on fate's door. His spiritual backers might back off if he requests their blessings on the wrong day. The astronomical records and instruments of the Ming imperial court were in dire need of recalibration since their heyday under Kublai Khan 4 centuries earlier. Highly advanced astronomical instruments lay weather-worn and neglected at the Beijing Observatory, because no one knew how to use them. Ricci was certain they'd been made by a foreigner versed in Western science, but they were, in fact, made under the watchful eye of Kublai Khan's foremost astronomer, Guo Shouqing, who had calculated the length of a year to within 30 seconds. Let's have a couple of dates. So Kublai Khan, 1215 to 1294. Guo Shouqing, 1231 to 1316, so quite some time before the Ming dynasty. While China's astronomical cutting edge may have become rusty, its printing and paper industries were far ahead of Europe's. Publishing was an easy, inexpensive means to proselytize, rather than preaching hell and damnation at the corner of the marketplace. To get the word out, Ricci became a prolific author. Yet his most popular work in China was neither a religious nor astronomical treatise. It was a map of the world. He made several versions of this map, but the crowning glory was the one commissioned by the Wanli emperor. Created with cartographical precision, Gleaned by globe-trotting Jesuits, the known world of the early 17th century was displayed across six huge panels. Prophetically repositioned, it was Asia, not Europe, that lay at the centre of the map. After all, the Chinese call their country Zhongguo, the Central States, or colloquially, the Middle Kingdom. Its mountains, rivers, and neighbouring countries were drawn up with the help of Ricci's Chinese colleagues. The Jesuits' knowledge of the solar system was set around the edges of the map, the distance between the Earth and other planets, proof that the sun is larger than the moon, and an explanation of the four seasons. Since His Imperial Majesty was the pivot of heaven and earth, it was only fitting that his entire domain was on display. Ricci never failed to educate through flattery when the opportunity arose. The map was also a diplomatic gamble to put Europe and China on equal footing. Europe was not the barbaric other. That was assigned to heathen tribes consigned to the far-flung edges of the map. Rather, these two great civilizations with their lengthy, eminent histories could complement and learn from one another. At the mission house in the imperial city, Ricci hosted legions of hopefuls who had come to Beijing to sit the civil service entrance exams. The young men had scant interest in conversion. They were just tourists checking out the local sights, but he entertained their intellectual curiosity nonetheless. After they left, he burned the midnight oil, not only to translate Chinese texts into Latin, but also classical Western texts, such as Euclid's Elements into Chinese. It's thought that he died of sheer exhaustion. With permission from the Wanli Emperor, whom he never met, his body was laid to rest in Beijing, an exception to the rule for foreigners whose remains were usually shipped back to Macau. Since disgruntled bones were believed to wreak havoc on the living, trusting that foreign bones would behave themselves as ancestral relics might have been the closest the Wanli Emperor came to an act of faith. The limitations of a four-centuries-old missionary agenda might be readily apparent in hindsight, but we would not have such a breadth of cross-cultural knowledge nowadays without the pioneering efforts of people like Ricci. Jesuit accounts of the ways of foreign people were popular in Europe. The German polymath Leibniz admired China's civil service, with its rigorous exams based on classical literature. He urged European countries to adopt the same system. Today's civil servants are, indeed, mandarins. Leibniz was also fascinated by the I Ching, the Book of Changes. Its hexagrams of broken and unbroken lines inspired him to formulate a binary system of counting, which in turn sowed the computational seeds for computer programming as binary code in later centuries. Where would we be today had Ricci not burned the midnight oil? As much as Jesuits appropriated Chinese ways to Christian ends, they also accommodated them. For example, a form of ancestor worship was still permitted. It was hard enough to persuade potential converts to forsake a favourite concubine or bow in front of a foreign priest. To renege on ancestral duties was too much to ask. Other Catholic orders who followed the Jesuits into China alerted the Vatican to the wayward practices, not least that the Jesuits permitted their converts to call Deus by unorthodox names, such as Shangdi. One century after Ricci's death, this controversy had become so entrenched that all Catholic orders faced a stark choice between Beijing and Rome. To gain an imperial permit to stay in China, the example of Matteo Ricci must be followed. That was the dictate from Beijing. But anyone who did so would be excommunicated. That was the dictate from Rome. The missionaries were stuck between a religious rock and a spiritual hard place. A final papal bull in 1742 decreed that no one was even allowed to discuss the matter. And so things remained for 200 years until 1939, when this ban was finally lifted. By then, the oracle bones had been unearthed, and the Shang pantheon revealed. On the topic of ancestral veneration, Ricci is still undergoing the lengthy administrative process of beatification. Whether or not he will be deemed a saint is also controversial, since his missionary methods have been both revered and chastised. His credentials are a little sparse according to the traditional criteria of miracles, but without doubt he performed miracles that were appropriate for his time. The China Millennium Monument in Beijing is a 100-meter-long relief built to commemorate the year 2000. Depicting 5,000 years of Chinese history and its influential figures, Ricci is one of just two Westerners to be honoured on this great wall of fame. As an ancestor, he has achieved great merit. Mission of the Five Elements. Conclusion. That Ricci favoured the Greek four elements over the Chinese five is not something I hold against him. I only wrote this article to explain why I do not use the five elements as a translation of Wu Xing. To learn about his remarkable life has been a bonus. Only a man of his intelligence and determination could have kept going through years of adversity. There were so many opportunities to lose faith, not least when Chinese converts were murdered by their own kinsmen. The late Pope Francis, also a Jesuit, saw Ricci as an ancestral mentor. And I quote here from His Holiness Pope Francis, "It is also necessary to pay special attention before the truth, goodness, and beauty of God. They should always be considered together and are precious allies in the commitment to defend human dignity, in building a peaceful coexistence, and in carefully preserving creation. This carefulness gives rise to a serene, sincere, and strong view of events, which is illuminated by Christ. Great figures such as Matteo Ricci are a model of it." Pope Francis delivered those words in 2013. As for the tenets of Wu Xing that Ricci was so keen to challenge, we'll revisit the two cycles of generation and control later in the Foundation series. Likewise, the role of Qi in early Chinese thought and the cosmogony of a primordial source giving rise to Yin Yang, the five phases, and through them the 10,000 things. We'll leave behind the religious politics of the late Ming Dynasty and the Holy Roman Empire as we turn towards the religious politics of China's earliest dynasties in the next issue.